And it is chapter 5, Laws of Prayer and Blessings of the Kohanim. A lot of very practical matters that we find in this chapter regarding prayer, relevant to this very day. So let's jump in. Aleph, Shemoyna Dvarim Tzarecha Mespal Lizar B'lem L'Asayisin. There are 8 things that somebody who prays has to be careful about and to do them. However, unlike things that he talked about in previous chapters, that if you don't do it, your prayer is almost worthless and you got to pray over again. These things, you're supposed to do it, it's important to do it, but if you didn't do it, it doesn't invalidate the prayer. You're not going to have to pray again. Therefore, if the person is pressured, or he's in a circumstance beyond his control, or if he went ahead and did it anyway without a good excuse, it's not going to invalidate your prayer. Now, what are those 8 things, you may be wondering? Number 1, amida, that you got to, how you stand, you got to stand during the prayer. Now, when we say prayer, by the way, we're talking about the Amida prayer. We're talking about the Shmon Esrei prayer. That's where all of these laws are most applicable and relevant. So you got to stand when you do the Amida. That's why it's called the Amida. It means to stand. V'noichach hamikdosh, and when you have to face the direction of the temple. Interesting, because people usually say, okay, which way is Jerusalem? But that's not 100% accurate, as we shall see. Because what if you're in Jerusalem? How do you face Jerusalem if you're in Jerusalem? So Rambam puts it very precisely, we face the Holy Temple, as we'll see. Sikun haguf. Rambam is going to explain each of these 8 things. Don't worry. Sikun haguf, and you have to prepare your body to be in a proper state. V'tikun hamabushim, you have to prepare your clothing to be appropriate for prayer. Tikun hamakom, you got to be in the right place. Vashvoya sakol, controlling your voice, not too loud, not too low. Vakriya, bowing. Vashtachvaya, prostration. These are the 8 things. Now the Rambam will go and explain each one by one. Number 2, amida ketzad. What does this mean, standing? You can only pray standing. Again, we're talking about the Amida prayer. The Shema, you could say sitting down. The rest of the, most of the prayers, you could say sitting down. Some parts, it's a custom to stand, but it's not a firm obligation to stand, like for Baruch Sha'amar, Yishtabach, and so forth. Amida, you must stand. Obviously, we'll say, okay, slow down. Hayesh b'svina, let's say you're sitting on a boat, oy ba'gola, or in a wagon. If you could stand, you should stand. Imlav, if you can't, because it's too shaky, then you should remain seated in your place and you should pray. A person who is ill, it's going to be hard for him to stand up. So he can pray even if he's laying on his side. He's not even sitting up. As long as he is capable of proper kavana, of actually focusing on the prayer. So, although it's critical to stand, if you physically cannot stand, either because of where you're at, or because, God forbid, of an illness, then prayer can be done while sitting or even lying down on one side in the case of a person who is ill. Somebody who is thirsty or hungry, they are considered within the group of people who are ill. If he has the capacity to have kavana to focus on his prayer, then he should do the prayer. But if he can't, he should not do the prayer until he eats and drinks. If somebody's riding on an animal, even though he has somebody who can hold on to his animal, hold on to the reins, as it were, he should not go off of his animal. He should stay on the animal and pray. Why? So that his mind will be calm and settled. Because if he gets off of the animal to pray, the whole time during his prayer, he's going to be agitated and anxious, oi, my animal's going to run away. And as Rambam says, even if somebody is holding on to it for him, he doesn't really trust that other person because it's not his animal. And so because it's going to disrupt his prayer, disrupt his concentration, he should better sit on the animal so he's calm and he can pray with kavana. Interesting off topic, well, not off topic, but kind of a spiritual interpretation of this possibly is, you never give up the reins of your own animal, your inner animal. Only you can really keep it under control. Number three, what does it mean to pray opposite the temple? Let's say a person is standing in Chutz La'aretz, which is outside the land of Israel. He should turn his face towards the land of Israel and pray. If he's in the land of Israel, then he should turn his face to Jerusalem. If he's in Jerusalem, then he should turn his face towards the Holy Temple. What if he's in the Holy Temple? Then he should focus his face towards the Holy of Holies. What if a person is blind? Or a person who doesn't have a compass and he doesn't know where is what and who's who? Or somebody who is on a boat? He should just think that he is standing opposite the Divine Presence, as if he's standing in front of the Holy of Holies, and he should pray. Number four, what does it mean to prepare your body properly for prayer? When a person is standing in prayer, he has to keep his 2 feet together. Again, we're talking about the Amida, the Shmon Esrei prayer. Your feet have to be together, touching each other. The idea behind this is that when we pray, we're supposed to be like the angels, and the angels are described as having one leg. And your eyes should be focused downwards. You shouldn't be looking all over the place. It's as if you're looking at the ground. The idea of looking down is also a kind of a humility. But your heart should be focused upward towards God, as if you are standing in the heavens, and that's where your heart is. So you're looking down, but your heart is in the heavens. And you place your hands upon your heart. By the way, this is not our custom, but this is what the Rambam is saying. You put your hands in your heart, the right hand on top of the left hand, and you're standing there like a servant in front of his master with fear and awe and trepidation. You should not put your hands on your hips during the Amida, but gets a little too casual. I know we're all on good terms with God, but a little respect. Number five, Tikkun HaMalbushim Ketzad. What does it mean that you have to have your clothing in a certain way? It says, before you pray, you're supposed to, you know, fix your clothing, make sure everything is nice and neat and presentable and beautiful. When you bow to God, it should be in resplendent holiness. And you shouldn't get up, stand up to pray wearing your undershirt only. That's how the Rambam interprets it. Others interpret afunda as a one's pouch. You shouldn't daven with a revealed head, meaning without a yarmulke. And you shouldn't daven barefoot, if it is the way of the people of that place, that they don't stand in front of important people without covering their feet. So here, interesting, the Rambam puts in that some of this is subjective to the customs of the place. So for example, in a place where people walk around barefoot and they'll go and have a meeting with the chieftain of the town without wearing shoes, then you can also come that way to God because that's the norm. That's considered respectful. Regardless of the custom of the place, you should not hold your tefillin in your hand or a Torah scroll in your arm and say the Amida at the same time. Why? Because Your mind, your heart is worried about the tefillin and the Torah because they're precious items, and you don't want to, God forbid, drop it, and so forth. And so you're not able to fully concentrate on the Amidah. But lo yeches kelim amayis biyada, it's by the same token, you shouldn't hold vessels or money in your hand, because again, that will take away from your concentration. Rather, however, you could pray and hold the lulav in your hand during the days of Sukkot. Why? Because that is the mitzvah of the day. Because lulav is the mitzvah of the day, so this is a little hard to understand. Why does the fact that it's the mitzvah of the day help? If anything, you're even more nervous. You don't want to drop that lulav and not have a lulav. So the Beis Yosef, and it's also in Rashi, basically say that because of your excitement for the mitzvah, because it's a mitzvah only for that day, unlike tefillin, which is a mitzvah every day, because of your excitement for the mitzvah of lulav, that excitement overrides the anxiety of possibly dropping it, and you're able to have the kavanah in the prayer even while holding the lulav. Let's say you have something, some kind of he says a burden. It's not a burden. If you had something on your head, you're carrying something on your head, a load, a package, and the time of prayer comes. So if this package is less than four kav is approximately 4 quarts, then you just swing it back over your shoulder, and you can daven with it while holding it. But if it's 4 kav or more, then you should put it on the floor and then pray. Because if it's so heavy, it's going to disrupt your concentration. Finally, the Rambam concludes this halacha and says that is the way of all the sages and their students, not to pray without having wrapped themselves in a talis. As is our custom today, especially for the Shacharit, that we put on a talis in order to say the prayer. Number 6, Tikkun HaMakom Ketzad. We're moving quickly through it because it's a long one. At the end, we'll ask questions and comments. Tikkun HaMakom Ketzad. What does it mean to fix the place, that the place should be proper? It says, Yam V'makom Namoch. You should stand in a low place. V'yachsev Panav L'Koysel. You should face the wall. Tzarech Leftei Chalenis. You should open windows or doors towards Jerusalem. By the way, this custom, we don't follow this custom. Kedelis Pal Kenegdan, in order to pray towards Jerusalem. As it says, V'chavin psichon lei b'ilise, that says in the book of Daniel that he had windows open in his room facing Jerusalem. Another thing he says is that you should have a regular set place where you daven, where you pray. So, for example, in the shul, you should have a seat, that's your seat. What happens if somebody's sitting in your seat? So if it's within 4 cubits, within 6 feet of your seat, it's also considered that you're in your place. So you don't have to kick them out. Hey, that's my seat. But the same thing if you pray at home for whatever reason. So you should have a place in your home. That's where you pray. Not one day in this room, one day in that room. It helps with the concentration that you're always in the same place. You should not pray in a place of ruins. Because it's dangerous. And you shouldn't pray behind a shul. Unless you're facing the shul. You know, you shouldn't have your back to the shul because it's a disrespect to the shul. You're not supposed to sit next to somebody who is standing and saying the Amida prayer. And you're not allowed to walk in front of him. You have to distance yourself 6 feet from the person who is praying. In other words, you don't want to disrupt the concentration of the person who is praying. Number 7, I just had this now at the Ohel. I was at the Ohel yesterday, and I needed to get my things, but there was somebody davening Shimon Esrei, so I had to wait for him to finish. Zion lo yamid b'makom gavoya shleisha tocham yosef yispal. A person should not stand on a place that is 3 tefachim, 3 handbreadths high or more and pray. Why? Because you're going to be nervous that you might fall. You shouldn't stand on a bed or on a bench or on a chair, all for the same reason. But if this was if it was a high, if it was a platform, but it, if it has 6 feet by 6 feet, which is the size of a house, then it is considered like a, you know, a second story, and you're allowed to pray in it because you have enough room that you're not nervous that you're going to fall off. If same thing, even if it's smaller, but if it has partitions around the edges, it's allowed to pray because you're not going to be nervous because of its height. It has its own area unto itself. You're not going to be worried about the height. You're not going to notice the height. Ches, number eight. Let's say you have employees, workers, that are doing work at the top of a tree. Or at the top of a board, on the top of a wall, and the time for prayer has arrived. What do? Do they pray up there on the top of the tree? Or do they come down to pray? Now, why shouldn't they come down? As we'll see, it's not so simple for them to come down because they're on the clock. They're getting paid by the hour. If they take the time to come down, they are taking off time from when they're supposed to be working. So let's see what the Rambam says. Vigiyas man tefila yerdin lamato. They go down from the tree or from the other things, and they pray, and then they return to their work. But if they're at the top of an olive tree or at the top of a te'ena, what's a te'ena? A fig tree. Then they should not come down from the tree. They should stay up there. They should pray in their place. They should torchon meruba, because it would be very difficult for them to go down and then back up these two trees, because they're very thick trees, a lot of branches, so it's a lot harder to get up and down. It takes more time, and therefore they shouldn't take that time away from their work. They should just pray up there. Umahin mispalalin, what should they pray? Okay, now I hear the Rambam's asking, do they pray the entire prayer, or do they just do a short one? So it depends. How much are they getting paid? If they're only getting paid their per diem, they're getting paid for their food, their meals, then they can say the entire prayer, the whole 19 blessings. But if they're actually getting paid, then they're supposed to say the short, abbreviated prayer. Either way, whether they're getting paid or whether they're only getting food, they should not lead the prayer, and they should not, duchen, if they are kohanim, they should not do the priestly blessings, because this is extra time that is not justified for them to take when they are on the clock. I will add that today it's not the custom for employees to say a short prayer. It's understood that the employer allows them to say the entire prayer from beginning to end, the whole 19 blessings. Number nine, Hashvoya Sakoil Keitzad. What does it mean to modulate your voice? Lo Yagbia Koile Bitvilase. Person should not pray loud when he's doing the Amida. Again, this is talking about particularly Amida. You're supposed to say it quietly. On the other hand, you shouldn't pray it silently in your heart where you're not even articulating the words. Rather, you've got to articulate the words with your lips, and you need to be able to hear what you are saying belachash, in an undertone. You need to be able to hear yourself, but nobody else should hear you, as it says in our Siddur, in the fine print right before Amida. The only time a person who is allowed to say the Amida loud is a person who is sick. And the reason for that is because the sick person is hard for him to concentrate to begin with, he's allowed to say it out loud. Or anybody who is unable to concentrate without raising his voice, then that's allowed. But as Rambam says, that's only if he's praying alone. But if he's praying with the congregation, he has no excuse to daven out loud, because he's going to confuse and disturb everybody else. So even when you're alone, you're not supposed to daven out loud. But especially in the Amida, especially when you are with a congregation, not to disturb others. Number 10, Kriya Ketzad. What are we talking about? Bowing. When do we bow during the Amida? So he says we bow five times during every single one of the three prayers of the day. When do we do it? In the first blessing, you bow at the beginning and you bow at the end. Right? When you say Baruch Atah Hashem right at the beginning of Amidah, you bow. And then at the end, Magen Avraham, you do so as well. And the same thing with the at the end of Amidah, with the blessing of thanksgiving, you bow at the beginning, you bow at the end. And at the end of the prayer, you bow, and then you take three steps backwards. And when you bow at the end of the prayer, you say Shalom from to your left. You lean towards your left while saying the word Shalom. Oseh Shalom. When you say Oseh Shalom, Rambam is not saying that, but he's saying you're taking leave of God. So you bow to your left, and then you bow to your right, and then you pick up your head and hold it up straight from the bowing. Now, when you bow during these four bowings, you bow at Baruch. When you say the word Baruch, we actually kneel, or we bend our knees. Sorry, we bend our knees at Baruch. And when you get to God's name, you stand up straight. Now, when do we say this? This is only a regular average person, a regular civilian. But a Kohen Gadol, the high priest, he is supposed to bow at the beginning of each blessing and at the end of each blessing. And a king, he bows at the beginning. And once he bows at the beginning, he doesn't pick up his head until he finishes a prayer. The king has to have even more humility than everybody else. And therefore, he bows throughout the Shmoneh Esrei, throughout the Amidah. Now the Rambam asks, number 11, why is it we always do everything in the right hand, the right side first, as we had even earlier in this chapter, that you put your right hand over your left hand and over your heart? Why is it that when we take leave of God, so to speak, we bow first to the left? The answer is because our left, if we're facing God, that is God's right side. So you're standing in front of the king and you are taking leave. So if you bow to your left, you're bowing to the right of the king. And then when you bow to the right, you're bowing to the left of the king. And our sages established it that when we finish the prayer, we take leave of God, so to speak, as one takes leave from a king. Number 12, all of these bowings that we do, you has to be a healthy, good bow so that the vertebrae of your spine are protruding and you make yourself like a bow. Again, this is not necessarily the custom in every synagogue. The Rebbe certainly did not bow in this fashion. If you bow a little bit, and you took some pain, and it looks like it has the appearance of that you're really bowing to the best of your capacity, that is enough. Number 13, what does it mean, prostration, after you pick up your head from the fifth? So now, basically, to cut to the chase, the Rambam here in Halacha 13 is talking about the Tachanun, which is after the Amidah. We say, Ashamnu, Bagadnu, I sinned, etc. And then you're supposed to, the way we do it today, we sit down and we put our head on our arm and we lean downward, we put our head on the table. This is what he's talking about here, the prostration, but you'll hear how it was done, a little bit different than how we do it today. Let's see what the Rambam says. Achshar may be a roishay mikrei chamishis. Once you finish your Amidah and you've picked up your head from your fifth bowing, from that, so to speak, parting from God, yeshiv laretz, you sit on the floor and fall upon your face to the ground, and you should say the tachanun, the beseeching of God, with all the various beseechings and supplications. Kriya ha'amur b'chomakim arbekayim. Okay, now he says that the word kriya, kneeling, refers to falling on one's knees. Kida, the word kida means falling on one's face. And ishtachavaya, bow, prostration, means stretching out your hands and your feet into like you're completely laying on the ground like we do on Yom Kippur. Number 14, when you do this falling on your face after the prayer, like we do today with the tachanun, yesh mishuei se kida, yesh mishuei se tachanun. Some people do it where they just bow and some people do it where they prostrate themselves. Here the Rambam reminds us that it is forbidden to bow down on a stone floor unless you're in the Holy Temple, as we explained in the laws of Avodat Kochavim, laws of idolatry. An important person is not allowed to fall upon his face unless he knows that he is a tzaddik, a righteous person at the level of Joshua. However, but he can lean his face forward a little bit, but he should not put it into the ground. In other words, this is something that specifically a great tzaddik is supposed to do. So somebody who's not at that level, he shouldn't do it. The post Amidah Tachanun and falling and prostration does not have to happen in the same place. One could happen here and one could happen there. And I believe this is the last halacha for tonight. Looks like we may get it in before 8 o'clock. Tesvav 15, Minak Pashut Bechol Yisrael. It is a accepted, widespread custom throughout the Jewish people that we don't do these penitential prostrations on Shabbat, which is a day of joy, and on festivals, nor on Rosh Hashanah, nor on Rosh Chodesh, nor on Hanukkah, nor on Purim, nor on the Mincha, which is the afternoon prayer that precedes Shabbat on a Friday, or the Mincha right before Yom Tov begins. Nor do we do any of these prostrations and supplications during the Mariv prayer, which is the evening nighttime prayer. There are some individuals, a minority of people, that have this custom to do the prostrations even at night at the Mariv prayer. And on Yom Kippur, that's the only day that we prostrate by every one of the prayers. Why? Because it is a day of supplication, requests, and fasting. That concludes the Rambam for today. Let's look at the test. Is one allowed to eat before davening if he's hungry? Anybody?
Yes, you're allowed to eat. You're supposed to eat first and then daven.
Okay. It's the exact answer, probably. I'm going to go with yes. If it will disturb his concentration, if he is sick. Let's see. Oh, we got it right. Kol hakavod. Which of the following things are allowed to be held in one's hand while praying? A lulav on Sukkot, tefillin, or a Sefer Torah?
Lulav on Sukkot.
All right, we got it. 2 out of 4. 2 out of 2. Is one permitted to daven while standing on a chair?
No.
No, it is. And should a person daven out loud?
No, again.
Okay, 4 out of 4. We are a huge success. We open it up to questions and or comments.
Thank you, Rebius.
Thank you.
I have a question. It's about not davening out loud or not being able to be heard by others. What if you're davening in a place that's a little bit noisy? Like I find if it's noisy, then even my usual voice, though, like I can't hear myself, so I have to raise my voice a little bit higher than usual. Is that permitted?
Are you talking about in a shul or in like an airport?
If you know the situation at the Hader, where there's a preschool going on during davening.
Oh, yes. I love that shul. Yes, then you're allowed. Yeah. You're allowed.
Okay, thank you.
My pleasure. Anybody?
Rabbi, yeah. Can you hear me?
I hear you.
Oh, you said you're not supposed to daven if you're hungry or uncomfortable. And there's an exception to that, I would think, on the fast days.
Right. Yes. Yeah. There's no choice.
Well, it's a bit of a contradiction. If you're really uncomfortable last days,
yeah,
you're not going to be concentrating.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, if a person really can't concentrate,
anyway.
I'll tell you the truth. So, when you look at the halacha, so Rambam is not always our guide to what we do practically, because, you know, the customs have Rambam, for example, is often the Sephardic custom. Many of us are doing the Ashkenazic custom. A lot of, even among the Sephardic Jews, not always is the Rambam's ruling the final ruling on things. So when it comes to these laws, it's a good caveat that we should make, is that the later codifiers said that today people don't really have such high levels of concentration to begin with. They're not concentrating so well on the prayers. So what I would say to about the fast day, we're able to have enough kavanah that, you know, we're able to have these days. And in other words, we're not at the level of kavanah of concentration and focus that the Rambam and the Talmud are talking about. And yet we do the prayers anyway, because this is what we're holding at and this is what we do. But it's a good point that if a person really can't concentrate at all, then he shouldn't pray.
One other question. Are there a lot of contradictions or any contradictions between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam?
Yeah.
Shulchan Aruch was quite a bit later.
Yeah, the Shulchan Aruch usually follows the Rambam because it's written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, who is a Sephardic Jew. But there are times where the Shulchan Aruch, I don't know the percentages, but there are plenty of times where he disagrees with or you know, comes to a different conclusion than the Rambam. Yeah.
So I have a quick go ahead.
Go ahead, Jacob. You started.
Oh, okay. I apologize. Whoever
you hit the buzzer first.
So Marvin, a reasoning or an hysterical perspective, why are we not wearing the tallit during the rest of the Amidah, Mincha? And where did that drop off where the tallit is no longer,
right, that we only wear it for Shacharit? That's a good question. I got to send that to our research department. I was thinking about the same thing.
Okay, well, thank you.
As you know, many do have the custom that at least the chazan wears the tallit during mincha, and Myrav as well. But a Chabad, we don't have that custom. Even the chazan doesn't wear it.
So I mean, sometimes, you know, I tend to want to wear a tallit if we do mincha on Shabbat, let's say, and you go read the Torah. And of course, there's some that don't wear it even then. At that point, they take it off. But so I'm always wondering why that is done, right?
Right. So, yeah, it's interesting. Chabad custom is we don't put on a tallis for an aliyah. But in my shul, if somebody wants to put on a tallis, for sure, let them put on the tallis, A. B, if you're not wearing a jacket, you know, in Chabad, you would be wearing a jacket and a hat when you got an aliyah. So if somebody is not wearing a jacket and he wants to put on a tallis, it's certainly better than going up without a jacket. But this is a very good question, why we don't do a tallis for mincha, you know, even if the other chazan is doing, what about everybody else?
Isn't there once or twice a year for Mika or
Adar
that one does wear a tallit?
Right. So Yom Kippur, we wear the tallis from the beginning of Yom Kippur to the end, including the mincha and marav of at the end of Yom Kippur. Yeah. Good point.
That's the only occasion, only on Yom Kippur.
Exactly. We do have it on Tisha B'Av. We wear the tallis as well for Mincha, not for Marav. So that would be the only two times. Now I'm still looking in the commentary here as we speak. According to one of the opinion of a commentary on the Rambam, Rabbi David Arama, he says that the Rambam says, the words the Rambam doesn't use the word tallis. He says, the way of the sages and their students, Shelo Yitbalu Elek Shein Atufin. Atufin means enwrapped. Now you could be enwrapped in a jacket. So that's how Rabbi David Arama explains it. So it doesn't necessarily require a tallis, and we know that because for many the custom is they don't wear a tallis until they get married. That's the Ashkenazic custom. When you get married, you wear a tallis. So why aren't we wearing a tallis before then? The answer is that what the Rambam says, atufin, enwrapped, doesn't necessarily have to mean an actual tallis. It could be a jacket. And indeed, as is the Chabad, the custom in general, in the in the Orthodox world that once a kid is bar mitzvah, they start wearing a jacket and a hat throughout for every one of the prayers.
I heard
the jacket.
Whoops, sorry.
Marcos, go ahead.
I better make myself visible. I heard a long time ago an explanation why when before getting married we don't wear a talis.
Okay, what was that?
That way from the women's gallery, girls can see who is single.
Who's single? Very good, very good.
That's what I was told.
I like it.
Very practical.
But they could be
very important.
But they could.
The Sephardic culture likes to confuse things. I could tell you that we, as even when you're young, as before bar mitzvah, you start having your little kids
wear talis
and so on across there.
Exactly. Exactly. Very interesting. Well, I could. Exactly.
And that's the essence of it, is that you're standing in front of the Creator through the prayer, through the Amidah, and that you have something over your shoulders that you're showing respect for where you are and being in the presence of the Creator.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so sorry to make this a long conversation, but I do believe, though, that the Talit would be a higher item to wear than, let's say, a wool or a silk jacket.
A blazer, yeah.
Typically the black jacket. I would think that if you wore the talit, it's you're wrapping yourself with the tzitzit, and depending on the ties you have and all of that stuff, you're actually doing a second wrap around you.
Right.
It's an interesting question. I know it's not an easy to answer. It's probably traditionally was not done at one point or was... And so it wasn't accepted as the majority or whatever that explanation that's done for that.
Right. So the talis has a much more powerful impact on our kavanah, and it has the Alter Rebbe and Tanya talks a little bit about it, of what it represents spiritually, which you don't have with your even your Giorgio Armani blazer. It's not going to do the trick. But again, if the Rambam, according to Rabbi David Arama, if he means you have to be in wrap, that's the minimal level of having the jacket in. So it makes sense that for the Shacharit, which is the main prayer of the day, it's much longer, it's much more, it's obviously the main prayer of the day, that it's done with the talis, means done with the tefillin, done with the talis and the tefillin. And the other prayers of the day don't require the talis, and instead we at least should have a jacket and a hat.
Rabbi, I wasn't clear at the beginning about facing, are we talking about facing the temple, facing Jerusalem? What was it about facing?
We're facing the temple. So if you're in Monterey, California, and you're facing the temple, you're also facing Jerusalem, and you're also facing Israel. But the most precise way to say it is you need to face the temple, because what happens if you're in Jerusalem? Then you've got to face the temple.
Okay, thank you.
Could we take one second or a minute and talk about the standing on the chair versus sitting on the chair? There is one holiday of Tish B'Av, I think, where you sit on a smaller chair.
Right.
Yeah. Why does one sit on a smaller chair? I mean, I understand why you would stand on a chair.
Right.
Where does the sitting on a smaller chair come in?
Right. The smalling on the sitting on the small chair is because Tisha B'Av is a day of mourning, so we're acting as mourners. We're not allowed to sit on a regular sized chair. Some people have the custom to sit on the floor, but people who don't like sitting on the floor, at least this is a lower, a stool or a small chair, that's kosher too. You don't have to send your Giorgio Armani pants to the cleaners. See, we already got a whole suit out of this class.
What about your Giorgio Armani talis?
I like it. As long as he wasn't the one who made the tzitzis, it's kosher. All right, friends, this has been another wonderful chapter of Rambam. We passed the test with flying colors. And I wish you a wonderful rest of the week. If you're in Shmateo, please join us for Fabrengen tomorrow night. And Kiddush Levana, if you haven't sanctified the new moon, it's a good time to do it. Laila Tov.
Hey, Laila Tov.
Laila Tov. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.